the Taiwan defense probably has about 3 or 4 days in it to kind of resist this attack. China has, People's Republic of China has 2,900 aircraft. Taiwan has about 470. So, you know, the Chinese have basically got, you know, 4 aircraft to lose to every one of Taiwan.
Professor McCoy, we have 30 seconds.
So basically what happened in a war like that, China, if the war went China's way, they would capture Taiwan before the United States main fleet could arrive from Honolulu. And in that case, the United States would again be an aggressor, would again look like we're attacking China. And we might face international condemnation for doing that.
Alfred McCoy, history professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison. His most recent book is titled To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. We'll link to your piece at Tom Dispatch, headlined At the Brink of War in the Pacific. Next up, we speak with progressive Democratic Congressmember Barbara Lee. She was the sole vote against military action in the days after 9/11. Now she's running for the U.S. Senate. Back in 30 seconds.
Every light is on and every room is empty except one. Oh, baby, don't stay too late. You know I hate to be alone, and I'm alone. Baby, won't you come on home? There's a man who's standing on the corner, and he keeps...
Won't you come on home, Joan Armatrading, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden announced his proposed $6.8 trillion budget plan Wednesday that would increase military spending while also introducing new social programs, reducing future budget deficits, and reigniting debate in the divided Congress on raising the debt limit. This comes after our next guest, Democratic Congressmember Barbara Lee, co-chair of the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus, introduced the People Over Pentagon Act to cut $100 billion from the defense budget and reallocate funds to overlook priorities like health care and education. This week, Congressmember Lee welcomed the passage of legislation to repeal the 2002 and 1991 authorizations for the use of military force out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, tweeting they'd, quote, marked up a bill to finally repeal the Iraq War authorizations, a moment I've been working towards for 20 years. Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer said it's his hope to bring the legislation to a vote on the floor by early next month. It was September 14, 2001, 3 days after the 9/11 attacks, when Congress held a five-hour debate on whether to grant the president expansive powers to use military force in retaliation for the attacks, which had passed in the Senate by a vote of 98-0. Congressmember Barbara Lee, her voice trembling with emotion as she spoke from the House floor, was the sole congressmember to vote no. The final vote, 420-1.
September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. As we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore.
That was 2001. Now Congressmember Lee is running for Senate from California to fill the seat being vacated by longtime Senator Dianne Feinstein.
I didn't quit when I refused to give the president completely unlimited war powers after September 11th and in the face of countless death threats. I was the only no vote. I didn't quit then, and I won't quit now.
Congressmember Lee is the third Democrat to run for Senator Feinstein's seat, along with Congressmembers Katie Porter of Orange County and Adam Schiff of Los Angeles. If elected, Lee would be just the third Black woman to serve in the U.S. Senate's 233-year history, after Carol Moseley Braun and now Vice President Kamala Harris. For more, Congressmember Lee joins us now, member of the powerful House Appropriations Committee, former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, chair emeritus emeritus of the Progressive Caucus and a member of the Steering and Policy Committee, the highest-ranking black woman appointed to House leadership. Congressmember Lee, welcome back to Democracy Now! This is the first time we're getting to talk to you since your announcement, why you want to run for the Senate, and how you would apply your views to what was just presented yesterday, President Biden proposing the budget, increasing the weapons budget, but also talking about preserving Social Security.
Well, thank you so much. Nice being with you again, Amy. And first of all, yes, I am running for the United States Senate, and I intend to win this race. There's so many issues that have not been addressed in the Senate, such as, and I'll just give you one, for example, you don't hear the debate around lifting people out of poverty and inequality from many senators at all. And, you know, in California, we have 20 million people living below the poverty line. And I'm running to make sure that we have a voice, that those people who are people and constituents who are marginalized know that they're being seen, and knowing that I'm fighting for an economy that works for everyone, including them, and food insecurity. You look at the climate crisis. You look at the housing crisis that we have in California and throughout the country. I have a lens that's unique. I'm a progressive black woman. I've been able to not only fight and stand strong and take on even my party at times, but I've been able to negotiate legislation and to get the job done in a way that you see now with the repeal, for example, of the authorization to use military force. Amy, I've tried over and over and over again to get the Senate to take this up. I have passed the repeal of the Iraq authorization in the House several times. I went to Senator Kaine and we started working together, and it took a while. But finally, this week, we got the repeal out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on a bipartisan vote. President Biden issued a statement of administration policy that he would sign it. He said that when I got it off of the House floor last year. And so it takes time. It's persistence, but I intend to be that persistent in the Senate and to fill some of those gaps that are there.
And Congressmember, I wanted to ask you about your people over the Pentagon Act. At a time when the United States is ramping up its military spending, billions being earmarked for the war in Ukraine, why do you feel it's so essential to reduce the Pentagon budget and utilize that those funds more for services to the American people?
Well, thank you for that question, because I didn't just start now in terms of taking on the Pentagon budget. You know that I worked for our beloved Congressman Ron Dellums for 11 years. He chaired the House Armed Services Committee. We have been trying to reduce defense spending forever, and we're making some progress in terms of building support, because so many members are afraid of touching the defense budget. But I just have to say, first of all, I don't vote for the National Defense Authorization Act because it's always been excessive. Secondly, a mere $100 billion cut doesn't even touch our national security, doesn't even touch what we need to do to help our troops. We need to invest more in supporting our troops. Many are on food stamps. Thirdly, we need to make sure that our domestic priorities are intact and moving forward. And we have resources here that we need in our own country for food insecurity issues, for homelessness, for all the issues you know so well, the domestic priorities. So $100 billion won't even touch it. Let me tell you, there's waste, fraud, and abuse, at least $150 billion that taxpayers have provided to the Pentagon that just is scammed. We can't even get the Pentagon to audit, to be audited. It failed one audit. And so the taxpayers ought to be very concerned about how waste, fraud, and abuse is taking place at the Pentagon through this budget, and to introduce an increase of $28 billion is unacceptable to me, because we have the resources to enhance and make sure our national security is strong with the $858 billion now that's there. And in fact, we need to cut it by at least $100 billion. That's a minimum cut that we need.
And could you talk about the president's proposed third budget? Aside from the Pentagon spending increase that you have criticized, what about other aspects of his budget appeal to you, even understanding that a lot of it will not get through the Republican-controlled House?
Well, I think aspects such as making sure that those who are wealthy pay their fair share. over 400,000 a year. And I think what the president has done is put forth a budget where he shows how to raise revenue, reduce the deficit that the Trump administration created as a result of the tax cuts for the wealthy. He's preserving Social Security and Medicare, making sure that, and I'm on the committee on House, the State and Foreign Operations Committee, which funds our development and diplomacy initiatives. He's provided for about an 11% increase because we've got to do more around the world in terms of development and diplomacy as it relates to global health, women's health. So the budget, I think, is reasonable. We're drilling down on it now to see exactly what it means for certain constituencies. But I think that and I serve on the Budget Committee and the Appropriations Committee. And so we're going to fight to make sure that the resources of our country go directly to the American people, because it's a budget for the people. And that's what we're saying. We're going to look at our funding priorities, because the budget is a moral document. It shows and demonstrates where our values are. And this budget shows that we're fighting for the people. I, again, oppose the defense spending portion of it, because I think that the Pentagon has enough resources. Our national security is strong. This Pentagon budget, once again, is excessive, and I think we need to put more resources into our domestic budget, because people need to be able to live their lives in a way that they deserve as Americans, and need to be able to have economic security so that they don't worry about the future for their children.
Congressmember Barbara Lee, if you could talk about this day and age we're in when it comes to reproductive rights. You not only bravely went to the floor over 20 years ago to be the lone vote against military action after 9/11, but you also, in terms of bravery, came out and talked about, on a very different subject, what happened to you decades ago growing up in El Paso at a time when Roe v. Wade didn't exist, as it doesn't now, and what that meant in your own life in having an abortion in this country, or having to leave this country to have one. And then talk about what it means to be, if you were to win, only the third Black woman in U.S. Senate history.
And, you know, yes, it was very difficult for me to talk about having an abortion, because, like it should be now, my mother and I decided it was our own personal business. It was my personal decision. It's a person's right to make those healthcare decisions. So I never talked about it. And then the stigma, of course. And so it was something that I kept to myself. What happened was, yes, I went to Juarez, Mexico, and it was a back alley. And I'll never forget that because I was terrified, because it was illegal. This was way before Roe versus Wade. It was illegal in the United States, of course, in California. I was in Southern California then, at San Fernando, and it was illegal in Mexico. And so I knew that I could die, because then Black women were dying from septic abortions disproportionately to any other type of the cause of death. And I knew that I could be put in jail because it was a criminal offense. And it was terrifying. I was one who survived, Amy. And, you know, it was a terrifying moment for me, for my mother. And so fast forward to today, when the Texas decisions and these restrictive laws came down, I felt compelled that finally I had to share my story so that people understood they had a member of Congress who saw them, who got it, who know that experience, and trying to fight to try to make sure that reproductive justice is available and reproductive freedom available for everyone. Because the fear now of being criminalized in these states, the fear of not being able to access abortion care and what people need to make their own healthcare decisions is traumatic. And so I decided to do that. And then as co-chair of the Pro-Choice Caucus, I have been fighting since day one to repeal, for example, the Hyde Amendment, which was a major step to get Democrats and Republicans to come together on. Because, you know, the Hyde Amendment denies access to abortion care for low-income women who are primarily women of color. So I introduced the EACH Act. No one thought we could get it done. But I've got close to 180 co-sponsors, which would repeal the Hyde Amendment. And then I've been able to keep it out of the appropriations bills for the last 2 years, because that's where the Hyde Amendment takes effect. So, you know, it's a lifetime struggle, Amy, and it's, you know, something that as a Black woman, I understand. And just transition to my comments about the Senate. You know, the lens of a Black woman has been missing. You mentioned how long it's been. That's since 1789. Only two African-American women serving a total of 10 years. And can you imagine the perspective of Black women and what it would do not only to strengthen and provide for more focus and living and providing for policies that would help the Black community, communities of color, low-income communities, working men and women. This helps our own country because Black women, when we lift up and crack these barriers and challenges, we're doing this not only for ourselves, but for everybody. We're doing it for everyone in this country, the LGBTQ community, Black and brown communities, low-income communities, poor communities, working families. We do this. We help strengthen our country to make liberty and justice for all real for everyone. And that lens, that perspective, my experience, that's not in the Senate now. And so I'm fighting, like you would not believe, to win this race. We're raising money at BarbaraLeeForCASenate.com. Low donors, recurring donors, people who can commit to $5 a month, $10 a month. That's how we're going to win this. It's a people-powered campaign, and I look forward to serving in the Senate to bring a perspective on every policy that's lacking and that's not there anymore.
And Congressman, Congresswoman, I know you only have a very little time left, but I just wanted to ask you if you could briefly, in the same vein, talk about this resolution that you introduced on International Women's Day with other women members of Congress on a feminist foreign policy. What would a feminist foreign policy look like?
Well, let me give you one example. I have legislation calling for women to be at the table when climate policies are being created. Women in vulnerable communities are most impacted by, and we have a climate crisis upon us. It is a crisis. And so women should be at the table on every single foreign policy issue, on every single climate issue. And so I believe highlighting this through my resolution gets the public aware of the fact that women are not at the table on so many issues throughout the world. And so I'm talking about women in our own country, but also women everywhere in the world. And the climate crisis is an example. Women are most impacted, women and children, behind the climate crisis because of the work that they do in their villages and in their communities. Why shouldn't they be sitting there helping develop the strategies that are going to mitigate against the planet burning at this point?
Barbara Lee, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Barbara Lee is Democratic Congress member from California, member of the House Appropriations Committee, and ranking member of the Subcommittee on State and Foreign Operations, serves as co-chair of the Steering and Policy Committee, former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, chair emeritus of the Progressive Caucus, co-chair of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus Health Task Force, and co-chair of the Pro-Choice Caucus, also serves as chair of the Task Force on Poverty and Opportunity, now running for the U.S. Senate. Thank you so much for being with us.
Nice being with you, Amy. Thank you.
Well, we're going to end today's show in Texas, where five women are suing Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risk to their health and were non-viable. The Center for Reproductive Rights is bringing the lawsuit on behalf of women and two doctors. They held a news conference Tuesday in Austin. We begin with Nancy Northup, president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights, who introduced Amanda Zarosky. First, Nancy Northup.
The Supreme Court's unwarranted reversal of Roe versus Wade has resulted in a health care crisis in states across the nation, including here in the state of Texas. It is now dangerous to be pregnant in Texas. Doctors and hospitals are turning patients away, even those in medical emergencies. Patients are being denied necessary, life-saving obstetrical care. Why? Because abortion is a crime in Texas, punishable by up to 99 years in prison. What the law is forcing physicians to do is weigh these very real threats of criminal prosecution against the health and well-being of their patients. We filed this lawsuit last night to stop the unnecessary pain, suffering, injury, and life-threatening complications caused by Texas's abortion ban. We filed this lawsuit so that patients will not be hindered, delayed, or denied necessary obstetrical care, including abortion care. This is the first lawsuit of its kind. It is the first lawsuit in which individual women have sued a state for the harm that they endured because abortion care has been criminalized in the wake of Roe's reversal. Five women have come forward to sue the state of Texas in this case. Amanda Zarowski, Lauren Miller, Lauren Hall, Anna Zagarian, and Ashley Brandt. Each of them suffered severe complications during their pregnancies. These five women are joined in this lawsuit by two obstetricians, Dr. Damla Karzan and Dr. Judy Levinson, who can no longer practice medicine as they were trained because Texas abortion bans pose catastrophic risks to their liberty. What we are seeking is a ruling from the court that clearly permits doctors to provide a pregnant patient with abortion care when in the doctor's good faith judgment and in consultation with the patient, the doctor determines that the patient has a physical emergent medical condition that poses a risk to their life or health. No one should be forced to wait until they are at death's door to receive health care. Such a ruling that we are seeking is the correct interpretation of Texas's abortion bans. It is also required under the Texas Constitution, which protects life, liberty, equality, and the right to be free from sex discrimination. These rights are guaranteed to every Texan, and they do not disappear because they are pregnant. Right now, abortion bans are exposing pregnant people to risks of death, illness, and injury, including the loss of fertility. Contrary to the stated purpose of furthering life, abortion bans are making it less likely that every family who wants to bring a child into the world will be able to do so and survive the experience. These women you will hear from today represent only the tip of the iceberg. This is the first lawsuit in the nation, but tragically, it is unlikely to be the last. This lawsuit, Zarowski versus Texas, seeks to rightfully return the life and death medical decisions to patients and their doctors and not leave them up to politicians and state officials. Now I would like to ask Amanda to come to the mic.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Amanda Zarowski, and I'm here to tell you a little bit about my experience with the Texas abortion bans. Thank you for being here. Indulge me for a moment and close your eyes. Picture someone you hold incredibly dear. Can you see them? Good. Now imagine someone telling you that you are going to lose that person in the very near future, but they can't tell you exactly when or how. And on top of that, there's a very high likelihood that you will get extremely sick, maybe even near death, as you wait for that person you love to die. Sounds like a pretty sick and twisted plot to a dystopian novel, but it's not. It's exactly what happened to me while pregnant in Texas. About 6 months ago, I was thrilled to be cruising through the second trimester of my very first pregnancy. I was carrying our daughter, Willow, who had finally blissfully been conceived after 18 months of grueling fertility treatment. My husband and I were beyond thrilled. Then, on a sunny August day, after I had just finished the invite list for the baby shower my sister was planning for me, everything changed. Some unexpected and curious symptoms arrived, and I contacted my obstetrician to be safe and was surprised when I was told to come in as soon as possible. After a brief examination, my husband and I received the harrowing news that I had dilated prematurely due to a condition known as cervical insufficiency. Soon after, my membranes ruptured, and we were told by multiple doctors that the loss of our daughter was inevitable. I asked what could be done to ensure the respectful passing of our baby, and what could protect me from a deadly infection now that my body was unprotected and vulnerable. My healthcare team was anguished as they explained there was nothing they could do because of Texas's anti-abortion laws, the latest of which, by the way, had taken effect 2 days after my water broke. It meant that even though we would, with complete certainty, lose Willow, my doctor could not intervene as long as her heart was beating or until I was sick enough for the ethics board at the hospital to consider my life at risk and permit the standard health care I needed at that point, an abortion. So even though I had lost all of my amniotic fluid, something an unborn child simply cannot survive without, we had to wait. I cannot adequately put into words the trauma and despair that comes with waiting to either lose your own life, your child's life, or both. For days, I was locked in this bizarre and avoidable hell. Would Willow's heart stop, or would I deteriorate to the brink of death? The answer arrived 3 very long days later. In a matter of minutes, I went from being physically healthy to developing sepsis, a condition in which bacteria in the blood develops into infection with the ability to kill in under an hour. I spent the next 3 days in the intensive care unit, surrounded by my family who booked last-minute flights because they feared for my life. I spent another 3 days in a less critical unit of the hospital, all because I was denied access to reasonable health care due to Texas's new abortion bans. What I needed was an abortion, a standard medical procedure. An abortion would have prevented the unnecessary harm and suffering that I endured. Not only the psychological trauma that came with 3 days of waiting, but the physical harm my body suffered, the extent of which is still being determined. I needed an abortion to protect my life and to protect the lives of my future babies that I dream and hope I can still have someday. 2 things I know for sure. The preventable harm inflicted on me will medically make it harder than it already was for me to get pregnant again. The barbaric restrictions our lawmakers have passed are having real life implications on real people. I may have been one of the first who was affected by the overturning of Roe in Texas, but I'm certainly not the last. More people have been and will continue to be harmed until we do something about it. The people in the building behind me have the power to fix this, yet they've done nothing. In fact, they're currently trying to pass even more restrictive measures. So it's not just for me and for our Willow that I stand here before you today. It's for every pregnant person and for everyone who knows and loves a pregnant person. It is with and for all Texans who, like me, are scared and outraged at the thought of being pregnant in this state that I stand and fight. Thank you.
Amanda Zurofsky, one of 5 women suing Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risk to their health and were non-viable. 2 doctors are also suing. The case was brought by the Center for Reproductive Rights. They held the news conference in Austin, Texas. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
From March 6th to March 10th, Art Week is happening at SFU Combo Mall. Each day, a different event will be running, so you could enjoy arts and science for the entire week. The Faculty of Art and Social Science Department Student Union President of the Week event. This is a good opportunity to meet with the past student. The event week is happening from March 6th to March 10th at the SFU Compo Mall. For more information, visit the SFU event page.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.